This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. This week, we begin the second of 4 weeks looking into the inside insofar as this is possible. This is our second week with Dr. Irina McCannon Scott. Her first book that we discussed last week was Sacred Corridors, Secrets Behind the Real Project Blue Book, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Roswell, the Battelle Institute, Memory Medal, J. Allen Hynek, and UFO cover-ups. And we actually covered a fair amount of that territory, but not all of it. So you should certainly get Sacred Corridors. It's very well worth having. If you want to understand this stuff, you can't sit back passively and listen to things on the internet, and above all, read all the fake stuff on the internet and get confused. You got to get it from the people who know what they're doing. And those are people who will, for example, appear on a very carefully curated show like Dreamland. This week, Irina Scott is going to be talking with me about Inside the Lightning Ball, scientific study of lifelong UFO experiences. Now, let me just remind you of Dr. Scott's bona fides. She received her PhD from the University of Missouri. She did postdoctoral work at Cornell. She has been an assistant professor at St. Bonaventure University and has done research and teaching at Ohio State, at the University of Missouri, the University of Nevada, and at the Battelle Memorial Institute, where UFO materials have been studied. She also worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency as a GS-11, that is a coded above top secret clearance. It's entirely real and documented. This is not a whistleblower with no credentials at all. She has worked at the Aerospace Center in satellite photography. She was a volunteer astronomer at Ohio State University Radio Observatory. She has published in many books about UFOs and is one of the few people to publish papers concerning UFOs in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. Irina, welcome back to Dreamland.
Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, it's exciting stuff. And, you know, folks, today we're going to start by talking about a subject that I don't think it'll surprise Irina to know. We've talked about a number of times on Dreamland, which is lightning. Of course, when Danian Brinkley and Elizabeth Krohn were here, both of them had their lives changed by lightning strikes. Now, Irina, you have had an exceptional amount of involvement with lightning. Can you tell us about this? Let's get started with this.
Okay. The first involvement I had was when I was 5 years old. I was in a house talking to my aunt, who was telling me about the Easter Bunny, and I was asking, how big is the Easter Bunny and everything? And there was a storm going outside. And I was small and standing by a window. And I was so small, when I looked up, I could see the sky. And right above me was a round ball, like a basketball, the color of lightning. And at the time, at 5 years old, I just started screaming and shrieking. And my aunt probably wondered what's wrong with me. And she said, well, this is because two storms ran into each other. And I'm sure she just thought, made that up. But that was my first experience with a lightning ball. And then I've had...
First experience. Here's the funny thing, folks. If you noticed, my first experience of a lightning ball. What is that about? Because have any of you had even one experience with a lightning ball? I haven't. I've had one. But go ahead.
Well, just as I was writing the book, I found it pretty odd to have... even one experience,
well,
and I
yeah.
found out that several members of my family had also had a number of experiences, but I had one that I can definitely confirm, and it was a really weird one. I mean, it was a really lightning bolt, but it was a weird one. I was in a mountainous area kind of on a crater between two volcanoes in Texas. And one of the direction looked over Marfa a long ways away, which is noted for the Marfa lights and everything. And the other looked over just a big crater. And I was standing out on the patio with my video camera recording. I was sort of recording scenery. And just suddenly, there was a lightning strike. And it was so close that I could see it. I could see the lightning bolt. And I was blinded and couldn't hear for a while, and came in with my recorder. What I'd seen was there's a lightning bolt and everything just turned white, like I was in the middle of a big white ball. And I couldn't believe that. And I came in with my video recorder. And when I started to be able to see again, I played it back and it didn't show anything except whiteness. And I thought, oh, this is nothing. I didn't get my bolt or anything. But anyway, later I came home and put it on my computer and slowed it down. And there was a lot more to it. And after that, I started reading about lightning bolts too. And what had happened was that I could slow down and see what happened was that, first of all, the lightning struck. And I saw a big whiteout, and so did my camera. Everything just went white. And later in studying that, I think I was actually inside a lightning bolt. It depends on your definition, but by a number of definitions, I could have been in one. And it didn't hurt me because laterally, horizontally, the lightning hit real close to me, like several feet away. But I was on a patio. And the patio had wooden pillars and everything. And it insulated me so that I didn't really get killed or anything, which I should have gotten. And then as I slowed down the video, I also saw that there was a cell tower about 150 feet away from me with guy wires. And what I photographed that I hadn't seen was that after the whiteout, you could see the electricity shorting up a guy wire to the cell phone, to the cell tower. And after that happened, I could hear the fire alarm go off. And you could, if you slow it down to parts of seconds, you could see all that very captured on the video. And so this is very odd because most of the time when somebody gets hit by lightning, they may die or be in real bad shape, and it ruined the camera too. But I was just lucked out and got a real good experience filmed on my video camera, and I put it on YouTube too. But you could see how strong the lightning was, because the cell tower was like approximately 150 feet away, and the guy wire just lit up for a while, just with big, what would you call them, sparks or shorts going up the wire. And the wire was a big, heavy thing. It wasn't like a electrical wire. So that would have, it probably had enough energy to kill anybody in a radius of about 125 feet or so around me. It was a very strong lightning bolt. And I was just lucky, and I can prove from that I was very near and maybe inside a lightning ball.
Wow. It's an amazing story. And folks, when we get back, we're going to start to talk about Irina's extensive, in fact, her life in UFO experiences and the kind of strange energy that seems to surround certain people. I mean, we just heard about from a person who lived through a lightning strike, just apparently by luck, that would have killed her if she had been standing just a few feet away. Now, but why is it? What is this that, what are lightning people? I'm not one. Are you? Do you get involved with lightning a lot? I'm kind of glad I don't, but We're talking to someone who not only is involved with lightning a lot, also has extensive UFO experiences and a security clearance and worked in the Defense Intelligence Agency analyzing photographs, including occasional UFO photographs that came along. We'll be right.
War Day is one of Whitley Strieber's most powerful books. Join him and his co-author Jim Konietka as they travel across the United States devastated by limited nuclear war. This acclaimed novel was originally published in the 1980s, but now that North Korea has said that they can hit the U.S. with nukes, it's more timely than ever. Don't miss this informative, exciting, and convincing testament to the power of the human spirit in challenging times like our own. Get the ebook for $3.99. Go to Strieber.com for this and all of Whitley's great books.
Irina McCannon Scott's website is irinascott.com, and that's Irina McCammon Scott, excuse me, is irinascott.com. Her book is Inside the Lightning Ball. You can get it by clicking through from this week's Dreamland. And between this book and Sacred Corridors, you are looking at stories and experiences from a person who has been behind the scenes for real, instead of a whistleblower who has all kinds of imaginative stories to tell, but no credentials. We got credentials, right, Irina?
Yes, I published my standard form 50 from the government in my last book, Inside the Lightning Ball.
Which is there, which I'm looking at right now. It's there. It's real. She was there. Now, we go from lightning balls and lightning to another type of mystery in the sky. Tell us about your first UFO sighting.
Well, my first UFO sighting was with my sister. We were very young kids. I think my sister was 4 years old and I was about 2 years older. And we had never heard of UFOs, so we weren't scared because we thought they were alien or anything. And this happened in our bedroom. And we were in rooms on both sides of an attic room. And I was asleep, and I woke up, and there was this little round thing that looked like hot metal flying around the room. And as I watched it, I knew it wasn't anything normal, like an insect or anything. It wasn't a lightning bug or anything like that, because it was different. It looked like metal. But it wasn't like an animate thing either, because it seemed to be guided. And we had furniture in the room, and it would come up to a wall or a piece of furniture and turn before it hit it. So it was something that knew where things were, and it would fly around the room but not hit anything. And I was just watching it. It came close to me and close to my head and close to my sister. And I didn't know she was awake, but it turned out later we were both awake. But we weren't talking because we didn't know each other was awake. And so anyway, it was flying around. And I think it seemed like it was more than a minute, because it seemed like I watched it for a while. And then it flew to the south end of the room and flew up to the ceiling. And it didn't hit the ceiling. It just flew up to the ceiling. And then it turned at a right angle before it got to the ceiling. And when the walls of the room sloped upwards, and there was about a space of 3 feet between the two walls at the top of the room. And there was in the middle of the room, there was a chandelier. And the chandelier had a small amount of space between it and the walls. Well, the ball turned the right angle, and then it went to the space between the chandelier and the two walls. And it didn't feel its way around or anything. It seemed to know where the walls and the chandelier were. And it began to circle the chandelier. And I was just watching in fascination, thinking, this is alive. It's not like something that's dead. It's not just like a spark or something. And it without feeling a thing, it starts circling the chandelier. And then in a perfectly geometric pattern, it made a spiral down. Well, just then I suddenly became so terrified, nobody could believe it. And so did my sister. And at that time, we both started shrieking and ran for the stairs. We fell down the stairs and ran shrieking to our parents. And they told us we were crazy and threatened to beat us up if we didn't go back upstairs and things. And then finally, my father went up and he said nothing was there. But we'd never heard of UFOs at that time. And when we did hear about them, we thought they were presented as like spaceships or something, not something in your room. And I never figured out that that had anything to do with UFOs until many years later. I read a book by Jenny Randall. I think it was called Star Children or something. And it talked about bedroom experiences that kids have. And children will have experience with a small ball of light like that. And then later, they often become repeaters where they have more than one sightings later. And that was in the 1990s, I first read that. And that it seemed to be like we had experienced, except for one difference. And usually it's one child that has experience, and then later may have other sightings. Well, in our case, we started out as kids having an experience together. And then years later, we had another experience of UFOs together, so that we were kind of different from normal, but it was kind of handy because we had two witnesses.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. You had two witnesses, and she remembered in years later as well.
My sister remembered it, and a whole lot of members of my family even remembered it and wrote reports when I finally did, you know, many years later, report it, because we were just so terrified.
Yeah. Now, what was the source of the terror?
I have no idea, and I speculated in my book. Our room was, the doors were closed to it, and the window was closed and everything, so we have no idea how anything got in our room. And it was a perfectly clear night, and we were sure of that for some reasons. But it wasn't like a lightning bolt because there was no lightning. It was just a clear, calm night. And we both woke up at the same time with a thing in the room watching it. And then we both suddenly became terrified at the same time. And I speculated in my book that maybe we were in some kind of mind control or something. Because it seems so strange that, you know, we both experience the same thing, especially getting scared at the same time, too.
You know, the interesting thing is that other witnesses have felt that there was some kind of field or something that caused them to become frightened. In other words, there was some sort of mind control involved. That could have been in my case, too, for all I know. But certainly that fear kind of comes out of nowhere.
And it was a bad fear. It's probably the scariest I about ever was. And I didn't even have a reason to get scared. I mean, I'd never heard of UFOs or aliens. And
right.
There wasn't any reason for it.
Well, when we get back, we're going to start talking about UFOs and aliens that she, after she did hear about them. And then later, we're going to get into the photographs that she's seen and worked on. We're talking to Irina McCammon Scott. Her book is Inside the Lightning Ball. Go to unknowncountry.com, click on the Amazon link for the book, and get the book from Amazon through us. It helps us a little bit when you go through us. We'll be right back.
War Day is one of Whitley Strieber's most powerful books. Join him and his co-author Jim Konietka as they travel across the United States devastated by limited nuclear war. This acclaimed novel was originally published in the 1980s, but now that North Korea has said that they can hit the U.S. with nukes, it's more timely than ever. Don't miss this informative, exciting, and convincing testament to the power of the human spirit in challenging times like our own. Get the ebook for $3.99. Go to Strieber.com for this and all of Whitley's great books.
We're talking to Irina McCammon Scott. Her website, irinascott.com. Her book, Inside the Lightning Ball, Scientific Study of Lifelong UFO Experiences. Now, at one point in the book, and early on, you say a very interesting statement, some publications have even considered that ball lightning might be a kind of life form. And could it be that you were sort of observed by this life form, and then these more physical things, such as the metal ball in your room, began to happen? Or am I going kind of down across a bridge with no other farther side?
I don't know, because I guess some people think they know what UFOs are, and I don't. And I just thought a lightning ball was a physical thing that, you know, was accepted. Well, it's not really accepted, understood by science. And there's a whole lot of complicated things about lightning bolts, too. I mean, lots of them are just standard lightning bolts. But some of them have some very strange behaviors, such as going through walls and things like that. And they also float. And I've read scientific papers saying that that antimatter can be created during this ball lightning is created. The lightning ball may contain all kinds of unusual physics, like quantum mechanics, actions and things like that. It was just really complicated. And so I don't think everything's known about lightning balls. And I think that in some cases, lightning balls might be similar to some UFO cases, because the lightning ball often is mysterious and not understood. And there's standard lightning balls, like if lightning hits and you see a ball fly away, it's probably a standard lightning ball. But some of them have pretty odd behavior, too.
Well, yeah, like the one that came into your room.
Yeah.
I
don't know if it's a lightning ball, though. I think it might be more like a UFO, because it seemed like it was guided.
And I have to ask this. This started to happen when you were very young. Do you have any sense of why you?
Well, it was why my sister, too. And we're sisters, but we have different personalities. She went into religion work, and I went into science. So we're not a whole lot alike. But it happened to both of us. And no, I don't have any idea.
And yet, here you are. You ended up at the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, am I looking at a guided life? Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I never worried about it too much until I started writing this book and thinking about things. And I had an interest in astronomy since I was just a really young kid. And I kind of wondered, as I was writing my book, whether that might have something to do with these experiences, and whether, as I thought about it as writing the book, that maybe there was something in my mind, like something unconscious, that had some connection with UFOs because of just that early experience with another witness of something that was kind of like mind control or something. And then other things happened that were pretty weird, too.
Can you tell us a few stories about the other things?
Okay. This is kind of long. I had an experience, my sister and I had a later experience in Massachusetts. We had gone to, I was living in Washington, D.C., working for the DIA, and she was taking postgraduate work at Drew University in New Jersey. And since we were on that end of the country, we decided to see the coastal states and New England states. And so I drove up with two co-workers and left them off at her dorm and took pictures of her and the dorm and coworkers. And then we drove up to Boston. And we got there before it was night, and it was still daylight. And we wanted to look around, so we took Route 3 out of Boston up through New Hampshire. And then it started getting darker, so we decided to head on back home. And later I found out that that had been the same place that the hill Betty and Barney had seen their UFOs that we'd sort of been on the same road. And anyway, we got back to Boston. I didn't know that then, but we got back to Boston and we took the Outer Belt 120 to Route 9 and went in Route 9 to the middle part of Boston and found nothing. And somebody told us that we'd have to look along the Outer Belt if we wanted to find a place to stay. And so we were heading out on west on Route 9, and we started seeing this object south of us. It was blinking, and there was an airport there. I think it was the Norwich Municipal Airport or something south of us, and we could watch airplanes come in and land from the east and see their landing lights and their red lights and everything. And this object was blinking, and it was lower than the airplanes, and it was a real white light that was bright and not like the airplanes. And my sister kept saying, "This is odd." And I kept telling her, "It's a helicopter blinking its landing lights," because being a scientist, I had to think of something logical, and that's what I thought of. And so we went to, drove on out to 120, and then took the Interstate 95 south. And we were still arguing, and this thing was still in front of us. We could still see the airplanes coming in. And we passed, there was a forest on the woods on the west side of the road, and about maybe 50 feet away from us, or approximately something like that, there was a light. And it was, I was guessing it was maybe basketball size, but I don't know, it might have been bigger. But it had, it was showing different parts of the spectrum, and it would go from different shades of red to different shades of blue to different shades of red. And it was just like it was rotating through a spectrum. And when we drove by it, the inside of the car lit up in green. And I couldn't understand that at all. And I looked around, and I couldn't see green any place. The funny light we were watching wasn't green. And I couldn't see a beam from any place. And so we kept on driving. At that time, you know, I didn't know that much about UFOs or anything. So anyway, we kept on driving. And after a while, my sister started yelling at me to stop, stop, it's going to go over the road. And I just wasn't paying attention to it. I would have never thought about looking at it because, it, you know, if it had been a UFO, I'd have thought that the freeway would be full of police and photographers and everything else and the TV stations and everything. And so I didn't pay attention to it, aside from arguing with her. But anyway, then I stopped and I looked out my window and I saw a meteor way off. And then this thing came over the road, and then I realized my sister had been right and that I should have been paying attention. And so I had a camera with me and high-speed film, and if I'd have even thought that this was something odd, I'd have loaded up my camera on the way down, but I didn't. And so I had a Polaroid camera with 3,000-speed film, and the film was, the camera was in the car, and the film was in the trunk, and I had to find the film and the camera, and it takes a while to load it and everything, too. And so finally, I had my camera about ready. The thing was shaped like a maybe a basketball or a blimp. It had seven things that looked like windows. They were square with right angle squares and everything. And we both knew what blimps were like because on our family farm, we had a freeway going right through it. And it was a freeway that blimps take. And so I had all kinds of pictures and experience, and we'd seen all kinds of blimps, including ones with lighted sides and everything. And this wasn't anything like a blimp. For one thing, it made no noise whatsoever. And anyway, I thought this was amazing. I'm going to get the picture of an inside of a UFO. This is just amazing. And I was ready to take it, and this truck driver pulled over. And I thought, oh, good, we'll have, and he walked toward me, and I thought, we'll have witnesses. And I thought that was great. And so he walked toward me and stood beside me, and he said, "What are you looking at?" And it was kind of obvious, but I pointed, and then he rotated around just the opposite direction and looked the opposite, just as far up in the sky, and said he didn't see anything. Then he rotated back and asked me the same question. And I said, gave the same answer. He rotated again and said he didn't see anything. And then he rotated back, looked at me, pointed to his head like, you know, I was insane or something like that, and went back to his truck. Well, I had missed this really good picture of what I thought was the inside of a UFO. And when I wrote that in my book, I wasn't thinking correctly then, because I thought I was still thinking this was an accident. But after my book came out, it occurred to me that if somebody asks you, you know, you point to somebody, to something, and somebody's trying to find it, they can't see it, they don't look in the opposite direction. They look, you know, around where they can't see it. And he just pointed in the opposite direction both times, so he knew exactly where it was, and said, "I don't see anything." So it wasn't an accident or something coincidental like I thought. But anyway, the object went over the airport, and it began circling, and it was circling and circling, and there was a pattern to its lighting arrangement when it circled. One part of the circle, it was so fast you couldn't even see it. But anyway, and we both observed and talked to each other about the airplanes aren't landing. They're up flying around above the airport, not landing. And so then I was trying to figure out what direction the thing would go. And I thought, it'll probably go north. This is a guess, you know, had been going south. And so I got my car onto the freeway, and I was going to go to the next intersection, turn around, and point my car north in case that's the direction it went. And then the truck driver got in right behind me. He began to chase me. And I'm sure he was chasing me because I slowed down, sped up, and changed lanes and everything else. And he just stood right just on my bumper. He was beaming his bright light into my mirror. I couldn't see anything. And so I was driving down the freeway blind as fast as I could go. And I decided, I thought we were going to get killed. And I said goodbye to my sister and everything, and asked her to look behind us because somebody was coming faster than us. I was going to get out by swerving out of the left-hand lane into the next, into an intersection. We went through several intersections, but finally I did that, and nobody killed us. And I was pretty surprised about that and happy.
When we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about that. You described this event more briefly in the show last week, but this business of menace is important, and because a lot of listeners have experienced menace of various kinds too, so, and as have I indeed, and so we'll get into your thoughts about menace and exactly what about this is menacing. We'll be right back. You know, The Afterlife Revolution is a funny book. It makes people happy, even though it's about the afterlife and thinking about crossing over. It made me happy to write it. And the reason it did was that I was actually in touch with Anne while I was writing it. And not only that, she proved it. She proved it clearly and completely. When you read the book, you'll see what I mean. You'll see why Dr. Gary Schwartz, who is one of the leading experts on the afterlife, considers it such an important book, why he wrote a foreword for it. Because this is about something real and incredible that we are told every day not to believe that we have souls and that we have an afterlife. Well, we do. We do. And the Afterlife Revolution is going to open the door for you, so you're not going to be thinking to yourself, maybe I don't, when you do. And that's why it's a book of joy. Go on Amazon, take a look at the great reviews, and get yourself a copy. It's available for your Kindle. It's available in paperback, and there's an audiobook read by me. And let me tell you something. You can hear something in my voice. People tell me that, and I think it's true. You know what it is? It's the inner joy that is part of me and has become part of me since this extraordinary thing happened. I have to say, Anne Streber was a remarkable person in this life, and she still is. Get it today.
Whitley Strieber's nonfiction is magical, powerful, and thought-provoking. From Communion to The Afterlife Revolution, there is no body of work like it in the world. Nothing even approaches it. And not only that, his wonderful fiction, from The Wolfen to his latest novel, New, offers reading and listening entertainment that you will never forget. And where do you find all this in one place? At Streber.com. That's where. Every Whitley Strieber book available for sale is there. So don't wait. Go to Streber.com and start exploring. There's only one Whitley and only one place to find all his work. Streber.com.
Well, free Dreamlanders, until the new website is deployed, you get to listen to the second half of the show. But I surely wish you would think about doing a donation to unknowncountry.com. Just go to the website and click on the donate button, and you can donate via PayPal very easily. Doesn't have to be much. Every little bit helps. But remember, our subscriber section is damaged, and most of our subscribers are not now paying for their subscription. So subscribers, this goes for you too. If you're not seeing us as Unknown Country or Walker and Collier on your credit card from time to time, then you're not actually paying, but you can use the site. You might think about making a donation too. So we are now going to talk a little bit about menace, because there is an atmosphere of menace throughout this whole experience. And have you experienced menace any other time other than that one incident where the truck driver, if he even was a normal truck driver, deflected you from what you were doing, which would have been an extraordinary photograph, and B, then seemingly would have been just as happy to kill you?
Yes. This kept on going, the UFO experience. After that, it stopped circling and headed northwest, and I continued following it, and followed by the light again, and the car inside of the car lit up in green. And then finally, I was in a real deserted old road with a lot of bumps and houses along way away and everything. I couldn't keep up with it, so I turned around and went back to New York. I was supposed to pick up the two coworkers from the DIA, and I waited all day, and I never heard from them. And finally, that night, I drove back to Washington. And when I went back to Washington, I had a poltergeist experience in my apartment that night. And so it was more involved than just what I said. I will have to think if I had any menacing experiences with UFOs. I don't think so. I don't know.
Well, tell us about the poltergeist experience.
Well, the poltergeist was, I'd never heard of poltergeist when this happened. And I was late at night, and I was going to bed, and I went to bed, and I started hearing somebody walking through my apartment, and I'd hear footsteps like a man that would walk around, and there was light coming in the window, a little bit of light coming in the windows from street lights, and I couldn't see anything, and I'd try to feel something when it got close, or even jump out of bed to where I heard it. And I was terrified, but I kept on hearing it. And in spite of being terrified, I went to sleep. Well, then my alarm went off, and I thought it was time to get up. And I got up and started making breakfast, and it occurred to me, it's dark. This isn't, you know. And so I looked at the clock, and I think it was 1:30. And I was just absolutely terrified. I went back to sleep again. The alarm went off at 2:30, 3:30, 4:30, I think 5:30. And each time I went back to sleep. And the alarm, I had the stub that you adjust it with broken, and I usually set it with pliers. And when I tried to set it back each time, I just very approximate. But it was set exactly on 1:30, 2:30 in each time. And so anyway, then I was sitting on my bed, not moving, thinking, I had never heard of poltergeist, and I thought I'd just gone insane. And if you're insane, you lose your security clearance, and that means you get fired. And so I was trying to figure out ways to disguise insanity at work and not talk to people and just going through that. And so my toothbrush flew across the room from nowhere, nothing behind me, and hit the wall. And then everything was over with. That I went to work and I was normal. I didn't wind up, you know, straitjacket or anything.
Yeah.
And everything was normal. That night, I took real good notes on everything that happened because I couldn't report it on account of my clearance.
Yeah, so, but you didn't mention at work that your toothbrush had flown across the room, I'm sure.
No, I didn't mention any of that.
No, I don't think so. Go ahead.
But anyway, this made me really nervous, the whole thing. And you can't go to work for the DIA and say, oh, I see UFOs, because you'd lose your job. But anyway, I mentioned UFOs. I just mentioned the subject. And I was working in a section where this particular area of the Earth, we were supposed to identify anything flying over this area with satellite photography. And Air Order Battle was our division or whatever you'd call it. And I expected everybody to laugh at me when I said UFO. And they didn't. And it turned out that my supervisors told me that right before I'd gone into the section, which wasn't very long ago, that they had reported a UFO on the satellite photography. And I got to see the photography and everything, too.
Wow. It was, can you tell us a little bit about exactly what it looked like?
Well, it was two missions. There were two photos, and one was on one mission, and another mission was 90 minutes later. And it was a little bit different place on the two missions. But I tried to adjust photographically so that they were the same size and look at it. And it looked like a disc with a real tall dome. And I wasn't sure about my, you know, usually there's standard ways to look at things, and I wasn't too sure about my way of looking at it, but I could see it in stereo. And so anyway, what the supervisor said was that there was a real odd reaction because we were supposed to be the authorities on our plot of land that we looked at. It was a big plot of land. I think it was in the Middle East or something. And they reported it, and we were supposed to know what we were doing and report it. Well, the higher-ups we reported to said that we didn't see anything that was a flaw in the film. I mean, they didn't see anything. They were reporting a flaw in the film. And it wasn't a flaw in the film because it was on two missions, and it looked a lot alike on both of them. And it just moved a little bit. And so anyway, they insisted that it wasn't a flaw in the film, and they had some experts look at it who said this was a real object, not a flaw in the film. But the DIA experts, or wherever it went, insisted it was a flaw in the film. And so that was a really weird reaction because we were trained, we were supposed to be authorities. And I think my supervisors might have been a GS-14 or something.
So, but that insistence meant that this was simply ignored.
I don't know if it was ignored because I interpreted that there's probably somebody high in the government that's debunking it for some reason.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think they would have ignored it. They would have been polite and told us, you know, reasons for saying that it was a flaw in the film. And there really wasn't a reason for saying that.
Now, this work was highly classified. You were in a windowless building with a safe combination pass, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so this was the Keyhole satellite program, am I right?
Uh-huh.
So that was a very classified program, and those satellites were such that they would not have been able, they would easily have been able to tell whether or not something on that film was a flaw in the film or not. There's no question about that, is there?
Yeah. Yeah, no, they said there was no question this wasn't a flaw in the film. I mean, you could see its shape and everything.
Yeah. And where was it?
Huh?
Where was it? Where geographically?
I don't remember exactly.
You mentioned the Black Sea.
Yeah, I think it was over the Black
Sea. Over the Black Sea, yeah.
Uh-huh. But close to land.
Right. And but it doesn't tell us much of anything except that, you know, UFOs are seen all over the world. And now, John Greenwald has put out something called the Defense Intelligence Agency's UFO Files. And do you know about that work? And if so, can you speak about it?
Well, at the time, I had no idea that the DIA was investigating UFOs. I found that out while I was doing research and writing my book. But apparently he thought that after Blue Book closed, that a lot of UFO reports were going to the DIA. And I was pretty nervous about my job. And I think it was the night after, two nights after I'd seen it, I went to a phone booth and called wherever I could find UFO, and I found UFO in the phone book. And so I reported, and it was NICAP, but I didn't get my name or anything because I was scared that there might be some relation between a UFO agency and the DIA. And so I was very careful to not, you know, because I was afraid of losing my security clearance if anybody found out. But apparently, as I found out later, I mean, recently, in the last couple of years, the DIA might have been investigating UFOs right while I was there, right while, you know, we reported that.
And you had a GS-11, but you were told it was a flaw in the film, when actually someone at a higher level probably was studying it very carefully.
Well, it made me think later that they stopped a lot of research a number of years ago at the end of Blue Book on studying UFOs. And it occurred to me that sometime later, when they had satellite photography, well, they were always talking about trying to take photography of UFOs. Well, when they had satellite photography, they could use that to look for UFOs too.
Yeah, of course they can, and they must do that because between the various agencies, the United States covers the sky every day, 24 hours a day, with high-level photography of various kinds at various different wavelengths of light. And you mention in your book, and let's talk about this a little bit, that some of this material is at wavelengths of light that we can't actually see. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, during my Massachusetts thing, I didn't get the picture of what looked like the inside of the UFO because of the crazy man I was talking to. But after he left, I tried to get a picture. And I had high-speed film, which was good. And so I was afraid I'd get lens flares if I stayed on the freeway. And so for some stupid reason, I don't know why, I climbed this hill. And at the top of the hill, there was an opening. And I very carefully waited and took 5 pictures of the objects. And then the Polaroid kind of complicated it, mechanical. You have to pull the film out and then coat it in different things. And so I pulled the film out and went down to the car and looked at it. And I only saw something on one photograph for some reason. But, you know, I was standing, I didn't have a tripod or anything like that. I just went up a hill and it was handheld. But one of my pictures turned out. And later I was a photo analyst, so I could analyze it. And it turned out that there was a light on this object that was invisible. When I'd taken the picture, it was so far away that I could just see one light. It was blinking. And when I magnified the picture and everything, well, actually, there were two lights. And due to my hands shaking because of it being handheld, there was a trace. And you could see that the two lights were different. And one of them came on a different time, and one of them stopped at a different time. And one of them was the same in brightness, and one of them varied in brightness. So they were quite a bit different. And from that, I concluded as a photo interpreter that there were two lights, and one of the lights on the object had been invisible to human light, to human eyes. And I checked with the Polaroid company, and there were wavelengths that the Polaroid would photograph, but that people couldn't see. So I figured it was probably in that range.
So we're looking here at something that is really extremely complex and that it has characteristics such as appearing, being able to appear and disappear, which in the film, the Navy Department film that was released on December of 2017, we actually see that happen. So these things do have the ability to completely disappear. And in fact, in my own life, I am engaging daily with beings that can disappear and do disappear. And we observe that at our cabin in upstate New York quite often. So this ability to control appearance and disappearance is real. And it's amazing and strange, too. Let me ask you this now, and go into a slightly different direction. Toward the end of his life, Kenneth Arnold, who had the 1947 sighting of over Mount Rainier that is so famous as the first well-publicized UFO sighting in the United States, toward the end of his life, his daughter reports that he began to think that he was looking at living beings rather than machines. How do you respond to that?
Well, my response is that I really don't know anything about UFOs. I've studied them for a long time, and I just don't understand them at all. And some of them may be living beings. I also hypothesize that, like, if they carry lights, they could have laser lights. It's make people see images such as holograms or volumetric displays that could disappear whatever they wanted to. And so I just don't know. I mean, they could be all kinds of things. And even studying lightning bolts, they're pretty mysterious too. And there's a lot of cases, you know, that I've studied of people where they see like a ball of light and it turns into a humanoid and things like that. And so it's just mysterious. I just don't understand it.
Yeah, my sister and some friends of hers saw a ball of light with a human being in it in the when they were camping out in a vacant lot behind our house back in the 1950s. So, yeah, that is also a common experience. Now, in September of 1986, you sent a letter to Bud Hopkins. Could you tell us about why you were inspired to do that?
Well, what happened was is that I had been living my normal life of having a family and working and different things, and all of a sudden I became terrified of UFOs, just out of the blue for no reason at all. And I started thinking about it for a while, at least. And so I contacted CUFOS, which is Dr. Hynek's organization, Center for UFO Studies, and said I wanted to make a report. My sister and I wanted to make a report on, you know, our former observations. And so they sent us forms. And I was at work that day. And I think it was break or something. And I started filling out the form. And while I was filling them out, I decided to walk downstairs for some reason. And I started down the stairs and looked up out a window. And there was this funny thing outside the window. And I saw an airplane go by. This was at Ohio State University in a lab. And I saw an airplane go by, and I was looking at the landing slope of what then was Port Columbus. An airplane went over. And so I asked somebody that was also on the stairs that I knew, what is that thing? And we both watched it, and neither of us had any idea. So we went to the office, the department office, and opened the window. there were a bunch of people in the office, and we were asking everybody, what on earth is this thing? And nobody had any idea. So I was able to get reports from five people. They've all been university professors now, so it was a highly qualified group of people that made drawings and descriptions of whatever we saw, and nobody had any idea why. And it lasted long enough that I called somebody at Battelle Memorial Institute who was a scientist, but he also investigated UFOs, and I knew about him. And he called the airport, and the airport said they couldn't get anything on their radar. I mean, that's what he said, they said. And they didn't see anything. He said he didn't see anything. But all of us in our office saw that. And it was big enough that it had an apparent diameter. It wasn't just a little spot. And I discovered later it was going against the wind. And so, anyway, that after that, I decided to do some more reports and look into UFOs because that seemed so weird. And I had other witnesses, which is pretty good. And so later I contacted Bud Hopkins about it. And he investigated, he interviewed my sister and her family with the person that he was writing a book about then in Indiana, and me, and tried to hypnotize me, and did a good investigation. I don't hypnotize at all, so there was some abduction. I didn't know anything about it. We might have had missing time, but that was all.
Now, one of the things that you point out in the book is something that relates to Betty Andreasen. This is a fascinating book, folks. Don't forget that. Inside the Lightning Ball. In any case, that there would be things that they would, the witnesses would forget, that would be triggered at later times in their lives to remember. Can you talk about what that means to you and what you think it may mean to those of us in this situation who may be having that experience right now, because some of us are.
I know. It would sure be scary to me. It seems to me like because of those coincidences and things that there might be something in my mind that's going on with UFOs, like, you know, something else is in my brain besides me or something. But people seem to be able to understand this or have it become conscious or something. But that's never happened to my sister and I. And I don't hypnotize at all. And she thinks it's flim flam, so we haven't done much exploration that way. But it's still in my mind that maybe there's something. Well, apparently it's conscious to a lot of people, but maybe there's something subconscious in your mind that you don't even know about that might be affecting you.
Well, folks, if you're getting things like this, write Whitley at Strieber.com and let me know if things are kind of popping up in your mind. That's been happening to me lately, and so if it's happening to you too, let us know, and we'll continue to talk about it on the air. Irina, you talk about psychic phenomena and dreams in relation to this, which is, of course, a huge subject for most of us. Do you feel that you became a psychic because of this, or are you a psychic?
I don't know, because I keep thinking, being a scientist, I keep thinking, well, there must be some kind of mathematics where you tell a coincidence from real life or something. And a lot of coincidences happen to me, but maybe they're just coincidences. I don't know. According to like Betty Andreasen and what she remembered, some of those coincidences were tied together and made sense if you're talking about something like UFOs or something. And like in my experience with the thing that happened in Boston, I had a UFO experience with another witness, so I know I wasn't crazy. And we discussed while we were going on, what do you see? Do you see the same thing I see? But then later I had a poltergeist experience, and I wondered if they're two forms of the same thing, which they well might be, because they're both not your usual experience. And so I just wondered if maybe there's something in some people, or maybe everybody's subconscious mind, that they don't know about that causes you see, the thing that's complicated is a physical reality too, although there's no way to prove it. And it causes things like that to happen. But it's just something that I, you know, my conscious mind isn't finding anything in the rest of my brain that, you know, that I can understand or explain.
Well, of course, as you know, as you report, and actually in your book and our previous, when we talked before, this is some years ago, I've been interested in Irina's work for a long time. And subscribers, of course, you can just search on Irina, just Irina Scott will be enough. Or if nothing comes up, then Irina McCammon Scott. And listen to the old show we've done with her. It was absolutely fascinating. But during that show, we had a lot of weird sounds, poltergeist activities, including the most ominous one, which was a sort of a growl that came out when we were talking about Bud, which was bizarre. Yeah. But in any case...
Yeah, I had to remember that for sure.
Yeah. So it was, anyway, it's been quite a good show, and I want to thank you for being with us, Irina, again, Irina McCammon Scott. Next week, we start 2 weeks with Diana Walsh-Pasulka. Diana has been on the show before, very briefly, our Christmas show, not this year, but the year before, talking about her book, American Cosmic, which goes even deeper into the hidden official world of UFO research. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Dreamland. Irina Scott's website, irinascott.com, her books, Inside the Lightning Ball, number one, number two, Sacred Corridors. Thanks for being with us again, Irina.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host, and I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander. Thank you for listening.